There can be little doubt that Persian agents would have been fanning out over the foothills of Oueta and Calidromus, waving gold before peasants, appealing for native guides. None had been forthcoming. Trachis, perched above the fissure of the nearby boulder-strewn Asopus Gorge, was openly hostile to the great king, and most of the locals had fled either into the mountains or to Leonidas. Some were left, however, and all it would take was for one Greek, just one, intimidated by the spectacle of the great king's magnificence, to crack. And magnificence, of course, was something that the great king did surpassingly well. That the great king felt a solemn obligation to open the eyes of Europe to its future in the new world order could be gauged from the leisurely pace of his advance from the Hellespont. This had left him arriving at Thermopylae perilously late in the campaigning season, but it had been important to Xerxes to instruct his new subjects in the character of the submission that they owed to him. While a succession of parades, regattas, and horse races had continued to flaunt the global scale of the great king's resources, so the contribution that the natives themselves were to make to this magnificence, and the abasement that they would graciously be permitted to display to their master, had been similarly driven home. Over the winter, every city on the expedition's path had been instructed to prepare a feast fit for a king. For months, the natives had done little except panic over menus. To be charged with preparing a dinner party to the opulent standards of Persepolis would have been headache enough for any hosts, but that was almost the least of their obligations. There were also the great king's soldiers to be fed, and his horses, mules, and camels. Wood had to be provided for the fires of the royal cooks. The cups on the great king's table had to be fashioned of silver and gold, the fittings of finest linen, the rugs and carpets of the softest and most luxurious materials that the wretched citizenry could afford. Nor, once these had been used, was there any prospect of them selling them off to help recoup expenses, since the Persians, like the worst kind of house guest, were in the habit of crating up all the furnishings and marching off, leaving not a single thing behind. No wonder that one wag, bled white by the honour of hosting the imperial army, had called on his fellow citizens to offer up thanks to the gods that King Xerxes was not in the habit of demanding breakfast as well. The prospect, then, that his army might starve, or even, perish the thought, that the royal table itself might stand empty, was a crisis of far more than mere logistics, for at risk were the very foundations of imperial prestige. Deprive the great king of his pudding, and morale might start to plummet. Not that it was an easy matter to catch out a bureaucracy so attentive to detail that it was in the habit of issuing travel chits to ducks. Extensive preparations had been made for just such a moment of crisis as was brewing at Thermopylae. Waterfowl would certainly have been brought in the imperial baggage train, but so also would any number of other delicacies to which the royal palate had grown accustomed. Acanthus oil from Carmania, dates from Babylon, cumin from Ethiopia. Even the great king's drinking water had been transported in great jars from a river near Susa. All the same, the supply of ingredients, and particularly fresh ingredients, had its limits, even for the peerless logistics chiefs of Persia. By the sixth day of the enforced halt at Thermopylae, the situation beyond the gilded confines of the royal tent, out among the teeming multitudes of the rank and file, was turning serious. Persian cooks, celebrated though they were, could hardly magic meals out of fields stripped bare. Yet Xerxes, though anxious about the rumbling in his soldiers' stomachs, knew that there were others who would be feeling the pinch even worse. The presence of the Persian army on their doorstep threatened local landowners with ruin. The obvious, indeed the only way for the natives to spare themselves utter destitution, was to help the great king flush the hot gates clear of its obstruction. Surely then, where the spectacle of royal invincibility had so far failed to recruit a guide, self-interest was bound to succeed? And so in the end it did, as amid the dust and disappointments of the second day's fighting, the Greek capacity for backstabbing came to the rescue of the Persian high command.